Hello and welcome to The World in 30 Minutes, the podcast on the events, policies and ideas that will shape the world from the European Council on Foreign Relations. My name is Mark Leonard. I'm director of ECFR. And this week we will be talking about German foreign policy. A little more than a year after Olaf Scholz delivered his Zeitenwende speech to the Bundestag, there's been much debate about how much has been actually achieved. How successful has the Zeitenwende been? What steps must Germany take in order to play a more active role in world affairs? And I could not have a more interesting guest to discuss all of these and many other questions than Christoph Heusgen. Christoph served as Angela Merkel's chief foreign policy advisor for 12 years, from 2005 to 2017. And afterwards worked as Germany's ambassador to the United Nations from 2017 to 2021. And in 2022, he succeeded Wolfgang Ischinger as the chairman of the Munich Security Conference. Before all of those things, he had a very active career, not least in Brussels, where he was part of the creation of a European foreign policy under Javier Solana. Christoph has drawn on this extraordinary career of shaping and implementing German and European foreign policy in a book which he has just published. It's called Führung und Verantwortung, Leadership and Responsibility in English, Angela Merkel's Foreign Policy and Germany's Future Role in the World. Christoph, thank you so much for joining.
Thank you very much, Mark, for having me.
So maybe we can just start with the moment that we're in now. And I'd like to look back on your experience later and hear some of the amazing stories that you have in your book. But you've just come back from organizing a hugely successful Munich Security Conference, the first that you did as the chairman. And I think it was a very interesting way that you put the event together. And one of the striking things about it was that you made quite a concerted effort to invite a lot of representatives from non-Western countries there and had various different panels about how the West and the rest are talking about the war in Ukraine. There's been a lot of debate about that, a lot of disappointment amongst Western countries that the coalition on supporting Ukraine, punishing Russia, is not larger than it is. And you know, somebody who spent a long time in New York talking to people from all over the world, maybe you can start with that. Give us a sense of, you know, after seeing all of these different representatives coming together in Munich, where you think we're at in terms of the rule-based order?
Oh, thanks very much, Mark. You took notice of the changes that I introduced into this year's Munich Security Conference. But before I talk a bit about the disappointment or expectations from the so-called Global South, let me say that what I found also reassuring was that the alliance supporting Ukraine remains very strong, and that was very important. It was demonstrated by the largest ever delegation from U.S. Congress that attended the Munich Security Conference, the vice president, and the message was very strong. We will support Ukraine as long as it takes, as the German chancellor put it in his speech. So that was reassuring, at least to a certain degree. But I had indeed invited representatives of the Global South because that was one of the really strongest impacts on my view on the political scene was when I was served in New York between 2017 and 2021, was that we have to pay much more attention to the so-called Global South, to Africa, Latin America, Asia, because we think we have the right argument and we are in favor of the UN and the UN Charter, etc., that we are the largest donor of at least the US and Germany. They are the largest donor of development aid, humanitarian aid. We say, well, somehow those countries will more or less follow us. And there it was very clear for me in New York that this is not the case. It is very clear that we are really in a competition, in a global competition where China and Russia, who are now even more in the same camp as they were before, where they are actually leading a competition, a polarization, where they try to gain support for their view of the world, for their view of the conflict. And we have to pay attention. If not, one of these days, for instance, in the General Assembly, we will be faced with a majority of countries voting with China and Russia. And therefore, it is very important that we take the concerns of these countries much more seriously than we have done in the past. And at the same time, also make clear to these countries in much regularly contacts what, you know, how is our take on the situation and why is it that we fight this war? Why we defend the UN Charter and rules-based order, and why China and Russia are actually trying to rewrite this order. So there are a lot of reasons why we have to be much more engaged with the countries of the Global South, and the Munich Security Conference try to make a contribution there. We can only do that, of course, with sending some signals, inviting people, giving a podium, hoping that the media pick it up. But it has to be something much more regular, taken up by the relevant governments.
So you spent a long time talking to people from all over the world who throw accusations of hypocrisy at the West, and lots of talk about how this rule-based order was made without a lot of other countries. And, you know, a lot of these arguments have come to the fore in the debate about Ukraine at the moment. What do you think the main lessons, apart from taking them seriously, showing up, talking to them, which is, you know, something which we haven't done such a great job of over the last year, are there specific ways that you, or arguments that you think would be more effective in terms of getting beyond the baggage which many Western decisions have when you take them into a forum like the UN?
Well, first of all, we have to do something very, very simple, and that is we have to be in touch with these countries much more regularly. Of course, you can do it at the UN, but you have to do it at their capitals. You have to be active in their countries. Looking at my own country, I see an absolute underrepresentation, although we have embassies all over the globe. When you come to any African country, or normal African country, Germany may have some 3 or 4 diplomats there. And but when you look across the street to the Chinese embassy in many countries, they have like 100 diplomats and much more active. So we have to be more present. We have at the same time to visit much more regularly. The Chinese foreign minister, after being elected, went directly to Africa. The Lavrov is said of having been, since after his country invaded Ukraine, Lavrov has been 4 times in Africa and trying to rally support and telling the Africans about their narrative. And while you ask our foreign ministers, secretary of state, German foreign minister, they have not been there that often. So we just have to be there much more present, and they have to understand that we are not there just, you know, to make demarches on a particular vote in the General Assembly, but we are there because we are really concerned. We want to listen to their needs, to their arguments, respond to it. And I think if we do that, if they see that they are seen on eye level, we have a better chance. Because when you look at the instruments, when you look at the means at our disposal, we are actually, at least in principle, in a much better stage. We talking about Germany, second largest donor of development aid worldwide, second largest donor humanitarian aid, versus second largest donor to the UN system. But we are not able to put all these means into to get results out of it. So what does that mean? I think we have to be much more visible. We also have, from a German perspective, have to put the different instruments that we have into one basket, you know, humanitarian aid, development aid, investment. We have to see that, you know, we get private business involved, and then we are able also, if we put all these instruments together, to respond to the needs of countries in the Global South who need investment in major infrastructure projects, and they usually turn to the Chinese. And so more affection, more presence, more regular presence and pooling of instruments. A lot of time has to go into this.
So you make a very persuasive case in the book about how we need a more active foreign policy. And you also talk about some of the kind of institutional means, like combining the RR with the BMZ in a more effective way so that we can do these things. And I'd love to move on to talking more about both about your experience of dealing with Putin and Russia, because that's obviously something which is a fascinating part of the book, but also about the transatlantic relationship as we look forward, the two big things which you've thought about and been involved with as much as anybody in the world. But before we do that, just as a kind of small aside, we recently heard about this new deal which the Chinese brokered between Iran and Saudi Arabia. And Iran is a country that you were very involved with diplomacy towards, both in Brussels and also from Berlin. How significant do you think that is? Is that partly a kind of symptom of us leaving too much space for China on the world stage? Is this the beginning of a new world order? You end up having a deal like that brokered by China rather than by the Europeans or Washington?
Yeah, it's what is happening there is a demonstration of us, the transatlantic community, failing. I mean, we shot ourselves into the foot when, after all these efforts that went into the JCPOA, that went into the nuclear agreement with Iran, when the Trump administration came, they stopped all this and didn't implement it anymore. And we tried somehow to keep it alive, but it was, of course, extremely, extremely difficult. And now with where Russia stands and China stands, this what I thought would have been potentially a basis for regaining of influence in the region was gone. And we see that our American friends have basically withdrawn from the Middle East, and they're no longer as present as they used to be. So people are looking around, look around at other actors, and these are, you know, most of the countries there are not democratic countries, so they don't mind looking at authoritarian countries that are engaged and offer their services. And with the U.S. not present, with the European Union not getting its act together and really being a player, although we could, but not being a player, then, you know, China is filling the void. And so in this very difficult situation between Iran and Saudi Arabia, it was the Chinese that got on the scene. And I don't know how much they're responsible for brokering it, but, you know, we have all of a sudden a rapprochement between a Saudi Arabia and Iran, which to a certain degree is positive because it lowers the chances of getting into a war there, which, you know, there was with, you know, Yemen and the Houthis fighting to a certain degree on behalf of the Iranians against Saudi Arabia. I think that helps now that maybe tensions around Yemen may calm down, but overall it strengthens also more the reputation of Iran, and Iran maybe has, the government will see this as a support in a situation where, because of their horrible acts against their own population, they are in the defensive. So it is a bit positive, but overall we see that authoritarian countries work together with the help of another authoritarian country. And that is not good for the rules-based order. That's not good for our interests.
So let's talk now about the war in Ukraine. In your book, you often refer to Angela Merkel's unique relationship with Putin. She seems to have had a way of handling him that few other Western leaders did. And I think she was crucial also to building European unity, one of the things which has managed to draw us through the current crisis. I think a lot of the roots of this crisis, but also of our response to the crisis, were sown while you were working for Chancellor Merkel. Can you talk a bit about how you think we got to where we are at the moment? Were you surprised by the decision to launch a full-scale war, by the way that Putin has been behaving? Is it the same Putin that you were dealing with when you were working for the Chancellor?
Russia has evolved, and I dealt with Putin until 2017. It was a Russia which was aggressive, without any doubt. They launched their invasion of Ukraine, first Crimea, and then Donbas, Luhansk, and Donetsk in 2015. At that time, it was possible through the leadership of Chancellor Merkel and, by the way, President Hollande of France to get Poroshenko and Putin around the table in June of 14 already at the Normandy summit. And the Chancellor and Hollande, they were able then, after the escalation in early 2015, to come to an agreement in Minsk. The Minsk agreement, which was a difficult agreement, but we were able to achieve this. It could have brought, if implemented, a stabilization, even peace between Ukraine and Russia, if implemented, as I said. So we tried very hard, the Chancellor in particular did, to, on the one hand, keep sanctions in place against Russia after the invasion of Ukraine, at the same time keep European unity with regard to sanctions, keep the transatlantic unity, which was, by the way, very strong during these days. So it was possible to somehow, you know, maintain the fragile situation of February 15. Now, I don't know exactly, because I was near, what happened between 17 and 21 after I've left. But one thing I know, and this is what the Chancellor was very concerned about, and this partially answers your question. The Chancellor, when I met her in late 21, she was still Chancellor in 21. The one thing she was very concerned is that COVID, the effects of the virus, had changed Putin. Because Putin, from early 2020 onwards, had not met with any Western or foreign leader of weight who would be ready to tell him the truth, to tell him that what he was coming up with in his fantasies was not true. And since this didn't happen for 2 years, the Chancellor at the end of 21 already was very concerned that Putin may turn into a wrong direction. So I think the fact that Putin was there alone in his dacha, not allowing advisors, and he had only Jay Sayers, you know, yes Sayers around him, they didn't get actually to him, let alone foreign people. I think that Putin then believed in his fantasies about this very strong Russian armed forces, about what he thought that Ukraine, he believes until today that there is no Ukrainian nationality or identity, that the Ukrainians actually are Russians, that they also didn't have a strong armed forces, and he, country, had one of the strongest. So this is what led him into this aggression, where he had a very hard wake-up call then when he missed to achieve his objectives. And coming to the current period, what I'm very concerned about, Mark, is that while we continue to support Ukraine, we see that Ukraine needs, over a longer period, support. We are somehow satisfied now that we sent these howitzers and we sent now also tanks, but we see on the ground that they are tough battles. So what I think we need to send the message to the political leadership is here in Europe, in the US, we need to continue the strong support for Ukraine, because Putin basically believes that we don't have sustained power. The Ukrainians won't, the Europeans won't, the Americans won't, and therefore just by staying there, continuing to with the aggression at some stage, Putin believes that we will somehow carve in or ask Zelensky to make a compromise he doesn't want to. So this is right now the point where we have to stay strong, we have to stay united, we have to continue to support Ukraine with money, with weapons, and we must not fall into the trap of some kind of Ukraine fatigue.
Absolutely. So we obviously all very active on different ways of trying to find ways of increasing the resolve of Europeans on Leopards, on other kinds of issues. But one of the big questions that a lot of people are asking is you know, how this ends and where it leads towards. You were involved in Normandy, as you described earlier, working with the Chancellor, with President Hollande and Putin in trying to find a way of at least stabilizing the situation after the annexation of Crimea and the beginning of the war in Donbass. Unfortunately, that Minsk settlement didn't end up resolving the conflict or creating the foundations for a stable peace. Has that changed the way that you think about the challenge now? I mean, how do you think that this war is likely to end? I mean, if we want to have a free, democratic Ukraine that can manage its own future, we are going to have some negotiations at the end, because there's no other way of making sure that Ukraine doesn't live in permanent fear of the war starting again. But obviously, we're not in a position now where there is much scope on either side to come to a negotiated settlement. But if we look forward, how do you think this, you know, how do you think we can put ourselves in a position where you could have that future for Ukraine? And what role will diplomacy play in it?
Yes, I think that's the most important question right now. I'm afraid that we are still far away, or at least we are not certainly not there yet where diplomacy could set in. I believe that we will witness still some time with military fighting and all the victims that this war costs. And I see time for diplomacy. One can prepare this, but I think that the time of diplomacy has come at the moment when the Ukrainians are of the opinion that to continue to advance and to continue to get back territory comes at a cost which is not proportional to the amount of victims that such a offensive to regain all of its territory would cost. So I think that we have to be at that situation where then, you know, Zelensky may decide that, yes, it's time for negotiations. It's time to kind of agree to a ceasefire, or maybe even without negotiations, come to the conclusions. Maybe we stop here and we have a situation as we have between North and South Korea without a peace treaty, but highly armed, but not much happening actually on the ground. But of course, this standoff there. This may come at a certain moment. We are certainly not there yet. What we need to prepare or think of course, is in particular, if we from our side encourage then Zelensky to agree with the Russians on some kind of stabilization or demarcation or even a peace deal. The one thing which we have to make different from last time, we have then to give the Ukrainians a very solid security guarantee. Even we have to consider at a certain stage also now actually have them enter NATO so that they can rely on Article 5 if the Russians should try and again attack them, because this is the experience of the Ukrainians, that they cannot trust the Russians, that the paper bearing a signature of the Russians is not, it doesn't have any value, not even the value of the piece of paper that's been written. Too often have they been disappointed, to say the least, by the Russians with the so-called Budapest Memorandum in 1994, where the Russians promised them their territorial integrity and sovereignty if in return they would give up the nuclear weapons, which they did. Also the Minsk agreements, they was also broken by the Russians. So they need some kind of guarantee that next time around the Russians will not break the treaty. So what I see, as I said, at some stage where we are not near that, where maybe both sides are exhausted, say that costs too much victims to continue. And this is widely shared in the population, which is important ingredient. Then we may say something, see something like Minsk 3, but with a strong security component to protect Ukraine from further adventures of the Russians.
One of the things I think we do need to talk about is the role of the US. We're both obviously very strong Atlanticists, and you were talking at the beginning about what an incredible display of American support there was at the Munich Security Conference, which comes after a year where the US has been engaged in European security in a way that it hadn't been for decades. And we all know that the Ukraine wouldn't exist today were it not for that support as an independent country. But at the same time, lots of people are looking towards 2024 with some kind of worries. You were in New York during the Trump administration and had to deal with a slightly less predictable and maybe a bit less friendly towards Europe administration during those days. Trump might very well come back as the Republican candidate, and even if he isn't, the other people who are vying to get the nomination of the Republican Party are echoing a lot of his rhetoric about America first. Whatever happens in this election, we all know from 2016 that politics can be very uncertain. What do you think Europeans should be doing now to prepare for political, you know, the dangers of political change in Washington? What do you think of the work that's been done so far over the last year when we had this very powerful wake-up call on the 24th of February last year? What would you be advising the Chancellor to do? Are you in your old job at the moment?
Well, first, I would say, you know, let's do everything to preserve this transatlantic unity. So continue to reach out to Congress. We had the largest ever Congress delegation at Munich, and Senator McConnell, the former majority leader, even brought expressively some, you know, young Republican senators, congressmen with him, just to make sure that they get this exposure to European security, to American commitment, also the reliance on the US. And I think this is what is appreciated all over Europe. Just to repeat myself, that how close this cooperation between the US and Europe is, how much it was key for Ukraine's survival that the US was ready to invest and deploy and send over so much weapons. So that is very important. But you point to the problem. Now, it will take until the end of next year, the end of 24, until there is a new American administration or new president is voted. I hope that by then maybe we have gotten much closer to a resolution of the conflict. But we need to do everything as Europeans to continue and tell our American friends how important European security also is for U.S. security, for the U.S. economy, and how much it's money well spent if you keep your troops over in Europe. But at the same time, and this is the main message also I try to convey to the German government, and many do that, is we have to become serious. It cannot be that 10 years after the Wales summit in Germany, the expenditure for weapons is still not at 2% GDP as we committed in Wales 10 years ago. It's rather at 1.5%. And we need to step up to the plate. We need to fulfill expectations, because this is basically the Trump argument at the time. Say, well, when I see as the contributions by the Europeans for their own security is not adequate, when I see it in my own country, US, so why did I spend so much money and invest so much also in European security if the Europeans don't do it? So number one, yes, keep close to the US. Number two, do your homework. And finally, become serious when it comes to fulfilling the 2% spending on arms, 2% of GDP, because this would get also the respect of Trump, and this would make it more likely that if Trump is elected or somebody of his the same mindset, that they can understand and they can even put, you know, take the record for themselves that finally Europe and Germany has fulfilled its obligation. So that's try everything to maintain transatlantic unity. Number two, we have to do our homework in Germany.
And to what extent do you regret the fact that when you were working in Berlin for different governments with Chancellor Merkel, that you were unable to change some of these long-standing challenges of German foreign policy, whether it was on the state of the Bundeswehr and defense spending, whether it was about Nord Stream 2, dependency on China? I mean, you have written about all of those things in your book and look at some of the kind of internal coalition politics around those different issues. But do you think that there are lessons to be learned from that period as well?
No, absolutely. I think that we have to, also this government has to understand that business as usual cannot and will not continue. I mean, there are a lot of explanations why, you know, Nord Stream 2 came about. It has to do a lot with our past, with our feeling of guilt or gratitude toward the Russians. It has to do a lot because of the fact that in the past, even in, you know, in the Cold War, Russia was always a reliable partner with energy supply. So what happened last year is a breach of civilization, a breach of tradition, a breach in our relationship. I think there are still many people in this country who have to struggle with the idea that change has happened, that things will not go back to the normal, and this will take leadership, a lot of explanation. But I think at least the majority of the people have understood the message. And as I said earlier, we have to see that we deliver on our promises, in particular that we you know, get available more arms for the German armed forces. And also we put aside enough money to support the Ukrainian armed forces.
I think that's all we got time for in terms of our discussions about the future and the past. But there is one thing left to do on our podcast, and that's our bookshelf section. Obviously, everybody should get Christoph's book, Führung und Verantwortung, for their bookshelf at the moment. But Christoph, what's on your bookshelf at the moment?
Well, if I may go back to last year, and since you're so kind to recommend my book, I would also highly recommend your book of last year, which is The Age of Unpeace, How Connectivity Causes Conflict, which has a lot to do with the topics that we discussed today. So I recommend all listeners to have Mark Leonard's and my book in their bookshelf.
Okay, that's it's an embarrassing kind of loving, but it's a nice place to end the podcast. If you've enjoyed listening to us, please do head to whatever platform you've used to download this episode from and subscribe to future episodes. And while you're there, it'd be great if you could give us a positive review and a 5-star rating, because it will help. We'll put links up to all of our publications that we mentioned at our website at ecfr.eu. But for now, from Christoph Heusgen and myself, Mark Leonard, it's goodbye. The researcher for this podcast is Anand Sundar, and the editor of this episode is Marlene Riedel. And I'd like to use this opportunity also to thank Marlene for all the incredible work she's done on the podcast for the last few years. Sadly, this will be the last podcast as she's editing, as she's moving on to bigger and better things beyond ECFR. But we'd all like to thank her very much for being such an integral part in the life of this podcast for such a long time. Thank you, Marlene.